session number 8263, reel 6.
Captain Ives Routliff, reel 6. You were telling me about the rate of fire on the 25 pounder.
We did eventually, although it was split ammunition, we did eventually at the at Karen, the gun program was set out for 7 rounds a minute. I think, with a really good detachment, you'd probably squeeze another round or two, but it was very, very hard going. You couldn't keep that up for very long. The question of the preparation for a barrage, that was all pre-planned, so there was no problem.
What about the effect of the shell when it arrived? How did the 25-pounder compare to the 18-pounder?
Well, with the 18-pounder, the shell fragment tended to sort of fountain up a bit, depending upon what sort of soil or ground they hit. And there seemed to be a forward thrust of these fragments. Whereas with the 25-pounder, with the delicate fuse and mechanism and so on, it left only a very, very shallow mark on the ground. And you had a more or less 360-degree sort of fragmentation area. So, that, and moreover, the shell would break up into an explosion into much smaller pieces than with the 18-pounder. The 18-pounder, sometimes, the thing would probably be about 6 or 7 inches long and about 2 or 3 inches wide. But with the 25, the thing's about the size of a 10p piece, probably, and do terrific damage. And the other thing, use that it had was if you wanted to sort of you're firing at a target, which you wanted the explosion of the shells to actually take place inside, we'll say, some fairly lightly built fortification or whatever. You could fire it with the safety cap on. That would flatten it on the first impact, but when it got through into the second one, the thing is already damaged, and then you get the explosion inside. I mean, it worked quite often, and we fired quite a few rounds with the cap on.
It was a delayed action.
Yeah, yeah. When you're going too quickly, phase one, phase two, one flattened, then the other explode.
Did you have armour-piercing rounds as well as high explosives?
Yeah, but not many. I think we only carried about, a dozen or so. The chances of the sort of thing that we, nature of the country we were in, after we got the 25-pounders, tanks were, it wasn't tank country.
Could you fire airburst with the 25-pounder?
There were fuse settings for this, but I'm not too sure because we never really use them. We use the thing with the 18-pounder, the shrapnel things, but then the other ones were smoke.
You said you had a week in Khartoum when you were taking these things over. What was Khartoum like as a place?
It was quite modern for Sudan. Extremely clean and well kept. Several quite nice shops. two or three bars, I think the Kitchener Bar, the Gordon Bar. And, well stocked with beer and spirits and so on. The troops had a whale of a time. Of course, when we got into Khartoum, John Gordon, the troop commander, went and saw the DAPM, I suppose, and said, look, my chaps have been in action since, you know, August. They've had no relaxation whatsoever, and I don't want any arrests. And that was the case. Well, one chap was arrested, of course. I mean, he'd be arrested anywhere. He was that sort of character of lad. Anyway, he was stuck in the guard room somewhere, and John Gordon went and got him out. And we had Christmas dinner and all that there, which was a great bonus. And there was a lot of excessive drinking, or it appeared to be excessive, but I think it was more. You know, we hadn't had any liquor right from the time we left India.
This chap who was arrested, what was he arrested for?
Oh, unruly behaviour, you know, probably put a brick through a shop window or something like that, and then resisting arrest with the red caps. It was him. I mean, he was one of these who couldn't hold liquor, and he couldn't keep out of trouble. They would have found something for him.
What was he like when he wasn't in drink then, when he was sober?
Oh, he was bombastic and mouthy. He was a boxer of sorts and tried to advertise the fact, you know, and always flexing his muscles and talking loud and long. But people regarded him more as a village idiot than anything else, you know. He had no brain. It's all brawn.
He sounds like the unit clown.
Yeah. Well, he was more more serious than that. I mean, he wasn't funny. He was bloody nasty. But no one cared much for him. He was one of these fellows that came from, I think, the 11th Field. I suppose they had a Thanksgiving service when they got rid of him.
What happened to him eventually? Did he?
Oh, he just
posted out or anything like
no,
that.
No, he stayed with the regiment, and no one of the survivors that I meet at the at our annual reunion ever heard of him. So, and as the regiment left on in North Africa, written off, I think, three times, and be probably killed up there.
Apart from drinking, having your Christmas dinner, what other entertainments were there in Khartoum? Were there cinemas?
There's a cinema showing the usual string of American pictures, and there wasn't really a lot of recreation in the barrack area. There's a swimming pool. There's a cinema in the barracks itself, in addition to the one in the town. But there was no great deal of pastime for soldiers. Half the time, you know, the troops were just lying in their tents and snoozing.
So you were in a tented camp, were you?
Yeah. The 160, 180 pounders or something.
Where did you go to then when you took off with the guns?
I beg your pardon?
When you left Khartoum with the guns.
Yeah, we went
presumably by motor transport.
No, we went by road. Or desert track. To the Gedarif area. There was quite a, you know, collection of troops forming up there. From Gedarif, had nothing much to offer. There were a few shops and things like that. And then we moved out from there to a place where it was just out in the wilds. Unfortunately, while we were there, I got a very serious throat infection, and went through the MO. I couldn't eat, and breath smelled terribly, and, you know, and throat was all, neck was all swollen up. Anyway, I was put in an isolation tent, you know, miles away from the MI tent, and was packed off to the hospital at, well, actually in Khartoum, it was in Omdurman, where the BMH was in there for about, you know, four or five weeks before I was, you know, really able to start eating without pain. I don't know what the infection was.
Have you any idea where you picked it up?
No idea. And I was the only one who had it.
What treatment did they give you?
Oh, gargling with that permanganate condies thing. And I think that was about all. I don't think they could have given me anything else, because that was the standard army kill-all stuff, wasn't it?
How did they actually get you to the hospital? Were you taken on
I got taken by ambulance to, I can't remember exactly now, but it could have been to Gedaref station and put on the train. By this time, the line to Khartoum had been opened, you know, Kassler, Khartoum, you know, that was it was all working right up, you know, the fork from Hire, where we were originally. No one, quite reasonably comfortable train too, but again on the train I was in isolation in a compartment all by myself, you know, one of the untouchables.
How long did it take them for the treatment to really get a grip of the disease?
Well, I probably. About 4 or 5 days in this isolation tent, and then put on the train. Then, but the day after, detrained at Khartoum and got on this on a ferry boat type thing. And it was a good fortnight before I started feeling the effects of getting well again. But I don't know what it was. I have no idea. The whole thing just swelled up completely. Couldn't eat.
Was the hospital in a building? Or was
Yes. It was a marvellous, marvellous hospital. It was, in fact, a university complex which had been taken over and made into the BMH. I can't remember the number of the, but it was really comfortable with spacious grounds and well-kept lawns and gardens and things like that. Food, excellent. Nurses, marvellous. They had a lot of auxiliaries. I suppose Red Cross nurses.
And was the hospital full of casualties, or was disease?
Oh, yeah, they were both, and not so many casualties, but you know, battle casualties. There obviously were a few in there, because nothing serious had happened at that time. On the Galabat front, in the early days when we went to Kassler, the few of the boys from the 3rd 57 Battery had been wounded, including Brigadier Slim and one or two other infantry people. But relatively speaking, they were small. The rest were people who had met with accidents and illnesses of some sort.
What did you do then when you were no longer under active treatment? Were you allowed to convalesce?
Yeah, I was allowed to wander around these spacious gardens, and they had cinema in the place, I think two shows a week or something, you know. We played cards and the usual sort of snakes and ladders or dominoes and darts, all those kind of things. The smaller indoor things, you know, to keep you amused. And of course, every day you had this, the ward inspection. You know, see, that the beds were, standing smartly to attention, and blankets properly sort of tucked in and so on. But quite natural, I mean, otherwise it would have been like an Italian hospital.
Who did this inspection? Was it the matron?
The matron used to come round sometimes, the MO's rounds. It was all in sundry, surgical people, but mainly it was matron. She was a bit of a tartar, but very nice.
Where was the regiment when you rejoined?
The regiment had gone through Cassler and to the next place at Teschenai, and this was in February. I came up again by train, and I was met at Castler by my number one, Sergeant Osborne. And I had about 30, 40-mile drive to it. I didn't see anything of the village. I don't think anyone did. Okay. We were in a palm grove alongside of very narrow, dry, sandy riverbed, but it was absolutely marvellous, and the place had been used as a bivouacking area by the Italians, because of the there were huts and all that made out of all these palm frods and things. So all one had to do was to clean them out and live in them. And from there we used to do a lot of training, which we're trying to really master these 25 pounders, for not so much for desert warfare, but for mountain warfare, because the difficulties and the hazards of Karen were already obvious to everyone. So the regiment was down at this Teschenai area. It was very nice there. From there, of course, the battle was going on with the 4th Indian Division at Karen.
How did you know of what was going on at
that time? We only had rumours. There was no sort of news sheet or anything put up. When our people went into Castler, they'd probably meet up with someone who's come down, to get ammunition from the railhead, or they'd meet in the Nafi and they'd say, oh, so-and-so's happening, and, so-and-so battalion's been made mincemeat of, or, so-and-so objective has been taken and lost, because this is what was going on, you see. Anyway, we as I say, relied purely on these little tidbits of information. But 3 weeks before the actual battle for Karen was being planned and started, our detachment, A subsection, went up alone into the valley. Now we occupied the position that the B troop number one gun would occupy, and for 3 weeks we did firing 2 or 3 rounds every 2 hours, 3 hours, something like that. And the gun was positioned behind a bun of sand and scrub. And it'd fire on a whole range of targets. I don't know why we just fired 2 or 3 rounds every 2 hours. Presumably it was just to fox the Italians so that they wouldn't get a line on us. But they did occasionally drop a few rounds, but it's the typical style, a plus, a minus, and then stop. You know, never went into fire for effect, which we were very grateful for. Well, this ranging on these different points went on for, let's say, 3 weeks. And it was from that information that the remainder of the guns in the 4th and 5th Indian Division were plotted in. That was putting... you see, this was just straight firing from map detail, line range and angle of sight. On top of that, there was a bit of the ranging as well. Now, added to this, of course, there was all the... from morning to evening, you had temperature changes, wind changes, and the temperature for the charges, and all this business, you see, all had to be added and subtracted to the information that we got. And therefore, when all this had been all put together, the artillery for the two divisions, plus any ancillaries like the Kashmir and Jhelum artillery and mediums, who sort of, they were a bit independent, I think, were all able to get the right detail at the right time of the day, because they'd had to keep changing, see, from 7 o'clock in the morning till midday. You see, there's a terrific change in temperature.
So you'd have different range tables
for
different times of day.
Well, this was all worked out by the GPO, gun position officer, and the gun programs were all laid on. See, but for just ordinary harassing fire, well, that, you know, it didn't really matter very much.
He must have had a very detailed set of records by the time he'd finished.
Oh yes, yes, that was and it was passed down the line, and also this. Every gun, pivot gun, was surveyed in so that there was absolutely no mistaking. And we used to be called upon for, just ordinary support for some infantry company, a battalion or whatever, that we happened to be putting in a attack, but for a proper planned move by the whole of the infantry that were going up these very, very rocky hills, the fire was absolutely accurate, and it was a creeping barrage. They just, 100, 200 yards ahead of the infantry all the time.
Was your gun properly dug in?
Oh, yes. We had done the 3 weeks of this detailed finding, the rest of the regiment came up, and we moved from the B troop pivot gun position to the A troop pivot gun position. And in no short space of time, because the whole regiment were in action. The ammunition was already around the gun pit. Not in any great quantity at that time, but just enough, you know, to see one through for any emergencies.
Could you see the Italian positions clearly from your...
Oh, you could see these hills very, very clearly, all the rock features, and they had, you know, these names like Sancho, Briggs Peak, and so on. They're quite easily... Yeah. It was just so high up. And we were down in this valley.
But were the actual positions clearly visible?
The Italian positions, yes, themselves? No, they were a bit too far for that. And there's so many rocks and things around there. I don't think the OP could see very much either. They knew where they were. And... any additional ranging that had to be done, you know, for purely and simply for the regimental or battery use, that was all taken care of, you know, for sort of defensive targets.
Were you within sight of the... Could the people on the hilltops on the other side have seen your position? Did they have a clear line of sight?
They probably wouldn't see us, but they would quite easily see the dust and sand that was blown up when the gun fired, or if they had binoculars or telescopes or something. I mean, they would, because we were right down in this long, broad, or wide valley, which was in fact a dry river bed, but a hell of a length and a hell of a width. There were odd trees growing here and there.
When you were doing your experimental shooting, did you have any infantry near you?
No, none at all. We were quite on our own. Because we were nearer to these hill ranges. That was going to be, you know, the artillery of the 5th Indian Division, and further down was covering another sector of these things was the 4th Indian Division.
What was your main task then once the battle commenced at Carron?
Well, the big push. Or the minor ones preceding it.
Well, once you'd finished your experimental shooting and the rest of the regiment came up, what